And hello out there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. And a day or two later, we podcast on iTunes. You can look for us at Writers on Writing or Stitcher. We're there too. Today is Wednesday, September 25th. 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelists Sarah Rose Eder and R.O. Kwan. And before we bring on Sarah, I want to thank those listeners who have written to us about the show. I've been asking, and Marie has been asking you to write to us at penonfire@earthlink.net. That's penonfire@earthlink.net. Just want to hear from you. Sometimes it feels as if we're broadcasting into the void. We're a college radio station and we don't do demographic studies, and we have no real way of knowing who is listening, if anyone is listening. And so I'm curious if anyone's out there. I do hear from you when the podcast goes down and asking what happened to it, and that happens occasionally, and then I know people are listening. But I would love to hear from you. I'd like to know if you listen on the radio at 9 a.m. on Wednesday when we broadcast live, or if you only listen to the podcast. At times, I think we should go direct to podcast so we would not have time constraints or language constraints, because the FCC may be listening, and, you know, there's that. So please email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. Let me know you're out there, what you like about the show, what you'd like to see happen differently, if anything, and all that. And so, let's bring on Sarah Rose Eder. She is the author of Tongue Party, selected by Deb Olin Unferth as the winner of the Cake Train Press Award. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in The Cut, Electric Literature, Guernica, Vice, The Black Warrior Review, Salt Hill Journal, and others, and she's been awarded residencies at Disquiet International Program in Portugal and the Gulkistan Writing Residency in Iceland. In 2017, she was the keynote speaker at the Society for the Study of American Women Writers Conference in Bordeaux, France, where she presented on surrealistic writing as a mode of feminism. She earned her MFA in fiction from Rosemont College. She's here today to talk about The Book of X, her first novel, which is, sorry, it can't be her first novel, right? Because she had Tongue Party. Maybe that was stories. We got to talk to her about that. But it's a novel out from $2 Radio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So tell me, was Tongue Party a collection of stories, or was that also a novel?
It was a chapbook.
Okay.
So it was about 90 pages. It was my graduate school thesis.
I see. Well, very cool that you had your thesis published. That's somewhat unusual, I think.
Yeah, whenever I go to colleges, I'm always telling students, send your thesis out because you never know what will happen.
That's very cool. So The Book of X, we're going to talk about The Book of X. I found it in equal parts poetic and surreal, this genetic abnormality that's passed down from grandmother to mother to daughter Cassie, the protagonist. So curious about how The Book of X came about and how the torsoed knot came to be.
I'm really inspired a lot by sculptures. And I'm frequently in an art museum. And I think in retrospect, I was really inspired by a Louise Bourgeois sculpture. And she was really sculpting a lot of knotted women. And so you see them in silver and fabric. And in retrospect, I think that was kind of subconsciously in my mind. But in terms of the book itself, I got this first line stuck in my head. I was born a knot like my mother and her mother before her. And I was awarded a writing residency in Iceland, and I just allowed myself to follow that story forward. So you could almost blame the first line.
So do you remember what was going on when that first line came to you? I mean, sometimes there are these pivotal moments that happen that books come out of. And I'm always curious, what were you doing? Where were you? What was going on around you?
I think I was thinking a lot about what we inherit, and I was thinking about wanting to discuss how we exist in the world when we're born into things like anxiety or depression and I think it's one of those things where sometimes you try to escape yourself, but you realize in retrospect that you're kind of still who you are, right? Wherever you go, there you are. And so there are ways in which our families might drive us nuts, but then we notice ourselves acting exactly the same way, you know? And so I really wanted to think about that.
And then you went to Iceland, you went to Gulkistan. Talk about that.
You know, honestly, Iceland was very interesting. I thought that I was going on a residency with a number of writers, but they all sort of backed out. So then I was alone in this cabin for 30 days. And it was really helpful because it gave me the freedom to play in my writing in a way that I think a lot of artists get to do, visual artists, I mean. So I really just took that time to explore all of these themes of capitalism, the female body, heredity, all of these kind of things. And I just gave myself space to play.
And then, so a month there, and did you finish the book? What happened? Did you have like a total draft that you then had to work with?
Yeah, so I wrote probably between 1,000 and 5,000 words a day. And I was reading a book by Robert Olin Butler called From Where You Dream.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a book about writing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's been on the show, I think, talking about that book.
Yeah, so he has this great advice about waking up every day and just going straight to the page. And that's really what I did with this book. And I think that kind of dream state gave me the freedom to invent things like the knot and the meat quarry and kind of create this new world whole cloth without asking myself any questions or editing or stopping myself. So I think I left Iceland with about 70,000 words as the first draft. And then I was editing for probably 3 or 4 years after that, which, you know, now the book is probably about half that long.
So what's the difference between writing in Iceland like that and writing at home?
You know, it was a real privilege and a luxury in retrospect. You know, I grew up with not a lot of money, and I think I spent about $3,000 to go on the trip total. And I know that financially I had, you know, saved my tax return, and I did. I bought myself 30 days. And I think in being able to leave America at a time when we had kind of elected Trump a few months before and I could kind of step out of the news cycle was a real luxury because it was so quiet there, and I was really isolated, you know, and I was just kind of surrounded by this beautiful landscape. And so I think a lot of the surrealism, or at least some of it, is really inspired by that too. The ability to just live in a draft for 30 days is very different for me. You know, I'm a working writer, so it's very different than writing on nights and weekends, you know. So it was a beautiful experience, and, you know, one that I'm hopeful I can do again, maybe not in Iceland, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned leaving right after the election or soon after the election. And as I was reading the Book of X, I was thinking about how Cassie and her mother and grandmother's knotted torso was a metaphor for so many things about being a woman, about being alive at this time. And so you were in Iceland, yet, of course, you bring your life with you to some extent. And so how much did what was going on, say, in the U.S. find its way into the book?
You know, I think it's really dealing with issues of the female body and being a woman. And I think, you know, it's a compilation of things that have happened to me or things that I've seen happen to other women. It's a way of looking at how women work in the world. But I would also say I didn't want to publish this book after I wrote it because there were so many dark themes. But I did feel politically after Trump was elected that it was necessary to let this work find its way into the world. And I think, you know, I think we're kind of seeing that movement happen with, you know, a lot of work today that is now more a direct reflection of these kind of unresolvable issues, right? There's no real resolving being a woman in the world. Like, we're still searching for equality. And that's true for so many different types of people in the world right now. And so I think we're seeing a moment in literature that's very interesting to me and very much like a direct response to the politics of our time.
Yeah, that's interesting. And $2 Radio is interesting, too. There's been a few authors that have been on the show from $2 Radio, Josh Moore with Sirens, and I wish I could remember her name, but The Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish. Katya, she was on the show, too. And I find $2 Radio really interesting in what they're putting out. And how did you find them?
You know, I had sent the book to probably 5 or 6 agents, like, you know, big time agents in New York, and they said, you know, this book is beautiful, but it's just too tragic. We cannot sell this. And I, you know, in drafts after that, I definitely softened it up. And I really gave up on the book at that point. I thought, you know, no one's going to publish this. It's too grotesque. And then $2 Radio ended up accepting it a few months later. And I felt so happy that that had been the home, because it's a press that is taking risks that much of the publishing industry isn't ready to take. And, you know, I think we have a lot of kind of revisionist history right now where we're like, oh, you know, this work is great. But the reality is there are so few presses that are willing to publish work like this. And I loved $2 Radio. You know, they came to see me read when I was on book tour for Tongue Party. I thought they were just a great operation. And so when they accepted it, I mean, I was just sobbing. I was so excited that it had found a home, and they've done justice to it all the way through.
So then I take it when you were writing it, you were not thinking about market or thinking about publishers or thinking any of that stuff that so gets in the way of the actual writing so often.
I'm so glad you asked that, because I'm really realizing that this industry is like the art happens in isolation, but you by yourself. And like what I'm doing now is the marketing, which is the selling of the book, the finding a way to introduce it to the market, using words like surreal and grotesque. And those are two very separate things. And so, you know, there's a part of me that's like so ready to get back to writing and to just go back into it in the next book, because I feel like, you know, I'm learning a lot about what the industry looks like and how it works, but, you know, the writing is the thing that matters the most. And I really was not expecting this book to ever see the light of day. And I genuinely mean that.
Yeah. It's gotten so much good press that it's really impressive. I'm so happy that it has, because it is different. And you know, I was trying to decide what genre it would fall into, because it has a bit of a few genres. It's, I mean, obviously literary fiction, but, you know, the surrealism aspect. And there's also a lot of aspects of noir, which I absolutely love. You know, I don't want to give away the ending, but the ending was quite noir. You know, it was surprising and not your typical ending.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a book of otherness. And I think if we look at the other in the history of literature and the history of pop culture and movies, someone who is not like the majority is not likely to ever become fully ingrained with people who aren't like them, you know. And it's like, I jokingly always bring up Edward Scissorhands, right? Because I love that movie, right? He tries so hard to fit in. He tries to get a job. You know, he comes down from this like place of isolation, and like he can only last in that society for so long. And so we do kind of look at these monsters and others. And I don't know that I would call Cassie a monster per se, but she is definitely different and othered. And, you know, I kind of knew from the beginning of the book, like she was never going to survive in the world because of who she was and how she was. And I had to really make peace with that too, because from a writing standpoint, it can hurt to create a character and watch them go through so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, back to marketing. So you often hear agents or people in publishing saying, you know, come up with your elevator pitch for your project. So if you're stuck with an agent or you visit with an agent, you can tell them, you know, very quickly what your book is about. Do you have that for this book?
You know, it's so funny because the language, you're right, it's kind of walking a lot of lines. I jokingly tell people, like, this is nonfiction, fiction, and memoir, like, put into a blender in some ways, right? Because I'm in this book some pages. But I usually say it's a surreal feminist novel that's very similar to a Black Mirror episode, you know? And I really feel that that is pretty true. It's about a woman born in the shape of a knot who tries to get a job and fall in love and all the things that come with that. So, you know, I don't know if that elevator pitch would ever sell the book, you know.
Yeah, I know. I've also heard writers say, I think Melissa Bank years ago was on the show. She's like, I would never know even how to write a novel, much less talk about what it is. You know, it's just like it's there.
And it is an interesting question, because everyone's asking you what shelf to put it on,
right?
You know, and as we have conversations with like other countries, even they're like, is this book horror? And you're like, I don't know, you know, put it on whatever shelf you want.
Right. Put it wherever you think. Well, the other thing about the book and about $2 Radio books is that they tend to be a little shorter and sometimes the same width, I think. But just, you know, in terms of fitting on the shelf, they would definitely stand out, you know, in terms of size.
Yeah, absolutely. And they gave me a lot of space to play with format and layout, you know, and I think that made me really happy because I think in the end, this book is only about 43,000 words, mm-hmm. which I think in traditional publishing wouldn't even be considered a novel.
Right.
And so, again, another way they took a risk and, you know, one that I'm so grateful for because I think a lot of people, this doesn't look like a traditional book on the page. And they worked really hard with me on layout decisions and the best way to make it work. So I feel lucky to have had them as a partner.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Sarah Rose Etter, The Book of X, published by $2 Radio. Your meat quarry was so evocative and imaginative, and especially as a vegetarian, I'm like, okay, but, you know, it just was so totally believable that this family, that this was the business, and I'm so curious how you came up with that.
You know, the interesting thing about surrealism is you're always looking for a way to kind of not place yourself in a time or a specific area, right? And so I wanted to talk about rural America and capitalism in a way that didn't make me have to put the family in a place and time, right? If they're farmers, if they're corn farmers, and all of a sudden I have to go research this equipment and figure out, you know, what was made when. And now I take away all the magic of surrealism and the suspension of belief that I'm asking of. So the meat quarry was really just a way for me to talk about manual labor, capitalism, earning money, rural America in this kind of displaced area. And I'm glad that it resonated with you, even as a vegetarian.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I knew about that before I even started reading. I heard you on an interview with somebody and talking about the meat quarry. And I went, okay, I'm gonna have to check this out. It so totally worked. It would be a good reason to become a vegetarian, but, I was,
you know, there's actually a huge history of literature on meat, you know, and I'm always reading kind of weird things in translation that come to me from other countries. And, you know, they're very much about meat and blood and physics and the body. And so it felt normal to me because there's kind of this lineage of literature around meat.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. So back to some of you in the book here and there, but not directly. Can you talk about how you conflated anything about yourself into characters or into the story?
You know, I did reach kind of a blurry period with this book of kind of not knowing the order of where she stopped and where I began, because as she moved through the world, I just started to like draw inspiration from things that had happened to me in my working life or the way that I have felt growing up in rural America and then moving into a city. And this idea of being raised in a place quite different from where I ended up living. And I think that is pretty true for a lot of Americans, right? Like we grow up in these small towns and then we try to go to the big city and kind of what happens to us there. And then on a more personal level, you know, I had a pretty serious spinal surgery. And I think, you know, eventually she had surgery to have her not removed. And that was very, very closely drawn from my experience. A lot of the things that happened to her, you know, when she's getting all these injections and things like that, those were things that had happened to me. And I think the kind of surrealism of taking your body through medical care in America right now is actually sadly not as surreal as it sounds.
Right. Yeah. So in doing that, did you know going in when you had your first line, as you started writing, that you would bring yourself into it in that way?
No, but I did know that I had to write my heart out. And I do think that, you know, I don't have any interest in writing from a third person point of view. I think almost everything I've ever written is from, you know, first person female, you know. So I can't help it. It's just how the words come to me. And I just followed it even into the scary places. You know, there's so much in this book I didn't want to write, and I had to force myself to write in a lot of ways. And you know, there are pages where even I'm repulsed. And so, you know, there is this kind of existential question of how could I write without being inside of it? I don't know if I could.
You know, I wasn't repulsed. I don't know. I've heard you say that on whatever interview I found that I just mentioned. And I kept waiting to be. I kept waiting to be repulsed, you know, and I just got into the world, I suppose, and into the, you know, the strangeness, and just, I was just there.
I'm so glad to hear that. I think I was trying really hard to make it human, even if it was weird. And I think, too, for people who are, you know, really well-read and always into experimental literature, this isn't the most experimental thing ever written, but I would say, you know, for mainstream American publishing, while I've been on book tour, you know, you get people who have never read anything like this before, mm-hmm. and so you get called weird or grotesque or surreal or strange because they have to label everything. But I would agree, you know, I think the early drafts were much more terrifying and repulsive. I think that it definitely calmed down a little. And I tried to do that on purpose. I weaved in those facts to kind of give some breathing room to the reader. Because if you read her story straight through and you take out the visions and the facts, it is pretty devastating. But I think by nature, I wanted to try to guide the reader to the end.
Yeah, by the way, I love those facts that tend to show up on the left-facing page. You know, it's like... And then at the end, I read about fact-checking, that you had to fact-check or something. What was that?
Well, you know, I'm going to give $2 Radio a lot of credit for that. They fact-checked every fact in the book. And, you know, there was this kind of funny back and forth. And it did hit me halfway through, like, we're fact-checking a fictional book. It did add another dimension to her character. It did add this idea that she was trying to understand the world through the mind of research, right? And that she was keeping track of everything that was happening to her. And there's also such a beautiful poetry in the fact of the world, right? Like whenever I watch Planet Earth, I'm always like, oh, what? You know, a cuttlefish does what? And so I really wanted to give her that dimension of trying to understand herself.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that aspect of it.
And
I can't believe we're at the end of our time. I wonder if, in closing, you have any advice for the writers who are listening, who are battling their way through perhaps a novel that doesn't fit a typical definition.
Don't think about selling it. Just go with it. And the rest will figure itself out. Don't think about your title or your publisher or your cover. Just get your first draft. Have fun. Explore. Be weird. Please be weird. We need so much more of that. And the rest will come.
Yeah. And, you know, I also wanted to ask you real quick, at what point did you share this with readers? Did you have readers that said, I don't know if you can ever do this, or did you just keep it to yourself until it was done and then try to find an agent? How did that go?
I had three people that I trusted. And I said, I need you to be gentle with me. And one of them happened to be the novelist Blake Butler, who's a close friend of mine. And then a few other people I had known from workshop, and like they understood what kind of writing I did. So I gave it to three people. And the first draft was truly unbearable. I mean, like when I talk about trauma, it was really, really bad. And one of them came back and said, you cannot publish this. This is devastating. And the other two said, you know, gave good feedback and gave me, you know, a lot of suggestions. But I was very lucky to have kind of those first three readers who were gentle with me and gave me encouragement. And I didn't mind that one person said, don't publish this, because I think you want to court a little bit of that. You know, I think you want to have some kind of a tension with the reader.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. And I thank you so much for coming on the show, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you for having me and for your great questions. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. That was Sarah Rose Eder, The Book of X, published by $2 Radio. Check it out. We're going to take a real short break. We will be back with Aro Kwan. Don't go anywhere.
Is this what we came for? Has this all been planned? Forever we're unsure. We're doomed and we're damned. The people in your life, the places you go, be sure they're just right. If they're wrong, you will know. If your days were numbered, stick around. Sleepwalk to your slumber. Set feet on the ground. Set feet under. Baby, we're all bound. Set feet under. All the lost get found. Tell me, are you ready? We're still far behind. The good times aren't steady. It's so hard to find. You're all work, no play, and unhappy still. Can't buy love anyway. All the time that you can. If your days were numbered, would you stick around? Sleepwalk to your slumber. 6 feet on the ground. 6 feet under. Baby, we're all bound. 6 feet under. All the lost get found. 6 feet under. Baby, we're all bound. 6 feet under. All the lost get. All the lost get.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. This show, along with hundreds upon hundreds of others, will be podcasts in the next few days. So if you just tuned in and you want to hear the first part of the show with Sarah Rosetter, go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when we podcast, it will fall into your podcast file and you can listen. And I should mention the archive of the shows is at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And we've been doing this for 21 years. It's very hard to believe. My kid was very short at the time. And I'd bring him here to the studio and I'd look at, there's a window in the door of the studio to see out into the lobby. And he was so short, I could never see him. And I just always hoped he was okay out there. But anyway, we're back. And I want to say that the same thing I said at the beginning of the show. I'd love to hear from you. Write to me at penonfire@earthlink.net and tell me you're listening. I want to know where you are. Are you in this country? I tend to hear from people in England, actually, especially when the podcast goes down. I get emails from England, sometimes Australia, sometimes the outback of Australia. And I love that. And maybe that's where all our listeners are. And that's fine with me. But I would just really like to know. So email me at penonfire@earthlink.net and tell me where you listen from. We have R.O. Kwan with us. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Paris Review, BuzzFeed, NPR, and elsewhere. She's received fellowships and awards from the National Endowment for the Arts, Yaddo, McDowell, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Sewanee Writers Conference. She was born in Seoul, Korea, and has lived most of her life in the United States. She's here to talk about her nationally best-selling first novel, The Incendiaries, published by Riverhead. It was named Best Book of the Year by more than 40 publications and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Award for Best First Book, the LA Times First Book Prize, and Northern California Independent Booksellers Association Fiction Prize. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you on. Gosh, I so want to know if you remember the genesis, or more precisely, the moment when the idea for the Incendiaries took root.
Yeah, of course. So, the book is rooted in my the fact that I myself grew up so Christian that I wanted to become a pastor. And then I lost that faith when I was 17, and so much of what I write, including this book, has to do with that loss and how enormous it felt to me, and still feels to me in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, it feels like the pivotal loss of my life around which everything has been organized. There's like a before and an after, and I feel as I'm living in the aftermath. The book is grappling a lot without the loss of faith, but also with how wonderful it can be to believe. That was like the first genesis.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, Phoebe, you have three point of view characters, Phoebe, Will, and John Leal, and they're all dealing with issues of faith. And so I was curious if one of the characters is more you than another, or are all of them a little bit of you?
Yeah. Maybe I'll quickly say for anyone who doesn't fully have the context. So what I usually tell people the book is about is I say it's about a woman who gets involved with a group of extremist Christians. The group turned out to be a cult, and they end up bombing abortion clinics, healthcare clinics, in the name of faith. And I worked on this book for 10 years. So for 10 years, I would attend a lot of parties and dinner parties and most stressfully, Thanksgivings, at which people would ask what I do, and I'd say I'm working on a novel. And I would give pretty much the sort of synopsis that I just gave. And by far the most common follow-up question was, is your novel autobiographical? Which I never quite knew what to do with. I think because on the face of it, it always felt as though people were asking, have you yourself been involved in a violent extremist cult? Have you led a violent extremist cult? Have you been involved in sort of terrorist activities? And so the short answer is no, but the long answer is that it does, as it's probably clear from just the past few minutes, it does have a lot to do with my own obsessions, my own losses. So all of this is a very long way of saying I feel close to all of them, and yet none of them are me.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure, sure. And as I recall, or something I read, I believe you started with one point of view character, which was Will, and at some point decided to bring in Phoebe and John Leal. Is that right?
Yeah. It actually, for the first 2 years of the 10 years, it was told entirely from Phoebe's point of view, so for the point of view of the woman who gets involved in the cult. And then I found that stepping away from having her be the primary narrator, I don't think I'm giving too much away if I say that she loses a great deal, she feels that she gains a great deal, and her experience of the world felt very spiky, felt very up and down in a way that... that felt more constricted to me. It felt more claustrophobic to me. And so I found that having Will, who loves her and opposes the cult and much of what it represents and is far less involved in the cult, having him narrate much more of the book just opened up a lot of air for the book. It just let me play with more of a variety of emotional registers. So that was actually the first big point of view change. And then eventually Phoebe's and John Leal, the cult leader's points of view started being added back in.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Will seems to have the longest sections, and John Leal has maybe, a paragraph on a page, maybe a little more than that. And I found that really interesting because John Leal would be the antagonist, if we were to define it that way. I don't know.
I know there are a lot of books, a lot of novels that never feel a need to answer this kind of a question about its own existence, but I needed this book to have a reason to exist, even inside of the confines of its own fictional world. And so in a lot of ways, I ended up conceiving of the book as Will trying to understand what happened, trying to explain to himself after the fact what happened. And that's, that's, of course, one of the big first questions that that comes up for people who love or loved someone who does something truly terrible. That's like the question that gets asked in the news of loved ones, of someone who became a terrorist, someone who was involved in mass violence in some way. Who the question is, how did this happen? How did this person I loved become someone who is seen, who's being seen as such a monster? And so the book is refracted through. The book never knows more than Will can either know or imagine about what happened to this woman he loved. How she became involved in this cult. And so the book doesn't know very much or nearly as much about John Leal, the cult leader, who in a lot of ways is a much more opaque person to the people around him.
Yeah, and his, I wanted to say his sections also are written with the most restraint, which is interesting, because he's perhaps the most, damaging character, the character to be most afraid of in a way.
I don't know. That's interesting. I'm thinking, I'm not sure I would necessarily think of him as the character to be the most afraid of. Clearly he, as a cult leader, he does cause harm, but other characters in the book also cause harm. I'm not sure that I would conceive of him as the most harmful person.
I was curious, about the thing about taking 10 years for the book. Can you at all break down those 10 years, how that went for you, and when you, at what point you felt that you had the book you needed to have, or what you were after to begin with, and when you knew you had that?
Sure, of course. Let's see. So, for me, a measure of doneness. So, I needed and wanted the book to get to a place where I could open it at random, read a line or two, and not want to change it all over again. And I think that took 10 years. I think part of it is, I love language. I love sentences. And part of how I decide what I'm going to read next, I have just like massive piles of guilt around my apartment, as I'm sure you do, as so many writers and readers do. All the books I bought, all the books that people have sent me that I plan to read, that I want to read. How I decide what I'm going to read next is usually I will pick a book out of the pile and I'll open it at random and I'll read two lines if those feel alive to me, if those feel exciting, if there's something there that tugs at me, then I decide, okay, this is what I want to read next. And so it turned out that I had to apply that same persnickety test to my own writing.
Yeah, and the book feels so crafted and so kind of, I don't know, I don't find a misplaced anything reading this. And so is there a draft that you go through? And I mean, do you have different ways of doing drafts at some point? Like, you know, I've heard writers say, you know, the first draft, the first few drafts, they're going lateral, and then they start going up, embellishing, filling things in. I mean, do you do anything like that? Or are you like getting a sentence, getting a paragraph just right before you move on to the next, so that by the time you get to the end of, I don't know, name the draft, the fifth draft or whatever, it's pretty much the way you want it?
Well, so the first, I spent the first 2 years just reworking the first 20 pages over and over again. I was very, again, as someone who loves sentences, I really wanted to get the language right. I wanted to get the prose right. But at the end of those 2 years, I threw away everything I had. And I realized that for me, with early drafts of a novel, it makes much more sense to go through early drafts as fast as I can. The first book, I used a variety of strategies to get myself more quickly through early drafts. Like I wrote several drafts by hand. I wrote one draft using a computer application that turned my laptop into a typewriter, and it only let me backspace one letter at a time, mm-hmm. so that I couldn't go back and, you know, like cut and paste. I couldn't move blocks of text around. I wrote a whole draft in which I turned every paragraph white as I went, mm-hmm. so that the font would blend into the background. I was just doing anything I could with the early drafts to get to just sort of put aside my obsession with language. And then once I had, you know, I have no idea how many at this point. Once I had a number of drafts down and had a much better sense of what this book was, what it wanted to be, that was when I let myself slow down. And so now something I do anytime I draft anything pretty much is I'll write like 3-5 words and then press enter. And then write 7 words and press enter and keep going. And so it ends up looking like a very long, very messy, sad, epic poem. But it's not an epic poem. It's just a way for me to have trouble looking at the sentence as a unit.
And then, of course, then you have to deal with formatting at some point, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, eventually I put it back, but then I break it apart again and put it back. That's pretty much how I draft anything at this point, is by spatially interfering with the prose.
That's interesting. And it also, what you said about writing the 20, you know, working with the first 20 pages for the first 2 years, and then throwing them out, supports the idea that you probably should breeze through a draft and not write the beginning to death, because so often it changes or it gets thrown out. I see this over and over again, just writers just dealing with the beginning, dealing with the first chapter for months and months, and you just go, no, go, keep going.
I realize that for me, I feel as I know writers who do actually who find it useful to work slowly, even in the early stages. But I think I realized, like, I might not, that at least for me, I have trouble. anytime I teach writing or talk to writing students, I feel as though the house of fiction is so large and it has so many rooms that I'm always saying things like, well, this is what works for me, but it might not be what works for you. I just just to, you know, this is just like one possibility. But yeah, I tend to avoid absolute statements, but for me at least, and for and you're right that for a lot of writers I know, it does need to help to work quickly at first.
And also you change. I mean, if you write a book, it takes you, you know, a few years to write a first draft. By the end of that draft, you're most likely a different person than when you began it. And I've just been thinking that more and more, you know, my next project, I just want to like get through it as fast as possible so that I'm not all that different by the end, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I feel so like I hear that a lot. And I don't know, somehow I was starting to get very worried about that with my novel, I think, especially by year, you know, 7, 8. I was worried about the extent to which I was still the same person I was 7 years ago, the extent to which I would remain the person I was with further revisions. But I think it just ended up not really feeling too much like a concern. But that said, I genuinely have no idea how many drafts the book ended up going through. In the end, it could have been like 50 drafts. It could have been 80. I don't really know, and it's almost as though I don't want to know.
Right.
I think I've forgotten a lot of what went into it, in part so that I can have the energy to be excited about working on the new book.
I think that's probably what people go through who have multiple children. You know, they have to forget about the first birth because otherwise, you know, would you ever go on to have another one? You know,
Yeah, this is what I hear. I don't have children, but this is what I hear from all my friends who've given birth, that their bodies just forget at least some part of what happened.
Yeah. You know, you have done so very many interviews for this book, and I am curious if there are questions you are never asked that you wish you were asked. Do you ever, you know, get through with an interview and I really wish they had asked about this or that?
I don't know. not really. I mean, it's been really lovely talking. You know what? People don't ask me very often what poetry I'm reading, and I feel so, I'm always really excited to talk about that. So,
I would love to know. What are you reading?
So the poet, Kaveh Akbar, whose word I really love, I was at a writer's conference recently where he gave a talk, and he read a poem by Nicole Seeley that just like, that I thought was incredible. So I've been going down. I've been reading a lot of Nicole Seeley these days.
And his name was
Kaveh Akbar. He's also wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that when you're working on fiction, you are reading fiction, or are you reading more poetry than fiction?
I definitely fiction is my first love, and I'm probably reading more fiction than anything else at pretty much all times, unless I'm deep in a research hole, in which case I might be reading a little more nonfiction, but even that won't last very long. So I read fiction the most, but I mean, I love reading all of it, like nonfiction, poetry. I increasingly have really enjoyed reading plays, too. But I do feel, I mean, again, the house of fiction is very large. I know there are prose writers who don't read very much poetry and don't miss it, but it just feels so that reading poetry, I think my prose would be so much worse off if I weren't reading poetry.
Yeah, your writing does have a certain, I don't know, I mean, now that you're saying you read poetry, I can see that in your work, because you know, so often you have chosen the right word or the right way to talk about something, again, with restraint. And I really like that about your work so much. And I love that you read poetry. And, you know, I think poetry should be a must for everyone who is writing anything, actually. I mean, journalists, it doesn't matter. I just think, you know, poetry gives so much. And I hear from fiction writers and journalists and all sorts of writers who, you know, they just can't read it. And I, you know, of course, I'm an evangelist for poetry, but it comes through. I mean, it comes through in your work, and I love that.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you for saying that.
We are getting to the end of the show, and I am curious about at what point do you share your work? Do you wait till you're completely done with a draft or done with a story or done with whatever you're working on to show it to anybody? And or does it go straight to an agent or an editor? How does that work for you?
I usually wait to show anyone anything until it feels pretty close to done, or not even close to done. That's not quite the right measure, since of course it's not. Until it feels as though I've at least to some extent taken it as far as I can take it, before having other eyes on it. And so before I show anything to anyone, things tend to be pretty polished, even if it's going to go through many more drafts. And at this point, my husband is actually my first reader. He's not a writer, but he's a very serious reader. He's a wonderful reader in the first place. But one of the things that I find to be very powerful about him, and which isn't the case with any writer friends I have, and which I wouldn't do with my agent or with my editor, is that I can really push him on. Or, I mean, I could, in theory, with friends, my agent and my editor, but so if you'll have a thought, I can really ask him like 100 follow-up questions about it, you know? Like why would you think that? What's going on? I can just like really interrogate him. And whereas like if a friend is reading a draft, I feel that that's already such a big such a kindness that I'm just going to take their edits and I'm going to engage with them on my own, but without pushing them on them. Whereas my husband is the one person I can push in this way and not feel guilty.
So that
leadership is extremely useful to me and very helpful. And then after that, my agent tends to read a draft pretty soon after that for me. And I have some friends in my life. I have a writing group that's been running a long time, and it's really wonderful. And
I wanted to ask you, how many words was The Incendiaries?
It was definitely on the shorter side. I think it ended up being about, I want to say 44,000 words. It shifted a little toward the end. But yeah, I want to say around 44,000 words.
It's a nice size. It's a nice size book. I like that. I love this size, actually.
Oh, thank you. It's about 45,000 words around there.
That's great. In closing, absolutely closing this time because we're out of time, is there any advice you've received along the way that's stuck with you and that you remember from an instructor or from a writing group or your husband or anyone along the way?
I think this is something that a lot of people say, and I never really believe them. And I'm going to say it, and probably nobody will believe me either, but maybe they will, is that... there really isn't, at least in my experience, and in all the experience of a lot of my friends, there really isn't any external validation that can ever feel as good or as real or as rewarding as the work itself, especially those glorious moments when the writing's going really well. And there's just really nothing like it for me. I think it's one of the best joys I know. And none of the rest of it has ever felt as joyful. But I know that's easy to say from the side of, or it sounds as though that it sounds like something that's easy to say from the side of having published the book, from having, but it's in the writing.
yeah, I agree. And I love that. And I thank you for taking the time to be on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That was R.O. Kwan. Her book is The Incendiaries. And check it out. Another good one. This has been a good show with good books, and I'm all out of time. So thanks for being here. Email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. Tell me what you think. See you next week.